harder. The DUP will win the seat because the DUP machine is better than the UUP machine, and I would go with that.
Yeah, I mean, there is a, and again, you're saying if the party's broken, can you win? You know, you've got a long time. You've got a long time to be becoming very relevant, becoming very real, becoming very ingrained in that community. A few weeks ago, when I broke my double figures on my elections, there was a council by election in the centre of Edinburgh, the city centre ward. That was a very important by election, and the city is run with the casting vote of the Lord Provost. So there's an even split. The Lib Dems and SNP have the majority. They're governing, but it's with the Lord Provost casting vote, and the Conservatives, Labour, and a couple of Greens are in the opposition. It was a key time in Edinburgh because we've got this farce of a trams project going on, which has been mismanaged and universally ridiculed. So I boldly, bravely stood for that by-election. Now, that was in the area where I stood earlier this year for Holyrood. I'd stood last year for Westminster, and I'd first stood for the council for that area in 2003 and came third. So this year, I came first. They changed the voting system by then, and I lost after the fifth round of transfers. Okay, but I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter. But a lot of that. Why did I get a swing from the? You know, that was one that the SNP. We got a 4% swing. It was one the SNP should have come first, and they came first in the last time it was fought. There was a swing from the SNP to myself. Some of that was because over the course of 7 years, I've knocked my pan, and in that area, I've worked my socks off. I was a candidate. Everybody knew I was there. I was committed. I wasn't just there for one election and then clearing off. No, this is my area. This is where I knew I'm on the board. Every charity, every school knows me. Every, you know, that just takes hard slog. It takes a long time for people, for that to sink into people that, yes, they're around, they're relevant, they're working hard. This is the person who is committed to this area. And you know what? That wasn't a case of changing the name. I've got a swing from the SNP to myself as a Scottish Conservative and Unionist, and all it took me was 7 years of hard work.
Somebody else?
Okay, well, I have a question mainly directed at Bill also Ian, with regards to how you work when you have a policy. For example, in the structure that you envisage, and that Ian in a way brought in the confusing candidates example, if you have the structure whereby the Unionist Party are working locally in conjunction with the Conservative Party, and you have a policy like universal tuition fees, which now, if you're from Northern Ireland, your tuition fees at Queen's are much lower, and of course that will appeal to the electorate, but it might actually not be in Northern Ireland's best interest for two reasons. A, it would make Queen's and the Ulster University even more parochial, which in no way can help Northern Ireland. And for example, if I'm correctly informed, there's no veterinary courses at Queen's, and of course Northern Ireland is heavily dependent on having people in the veterinary profession, so if no one's going to pay the extra money that it would cost to go and do that in England, etc., etc. So what I'm trying to get at, here's a policy that on the outset might look like it's best to take one view in order to get the vote from your electorate, but actually it's not in that electorate's best interest, and it also might come at a collision course with the national government. How would you navigate that sort of situation under your proposal?
Good politics is about making the tough decisions, something I believe politicians in Northern Ireland have yet to learn. I do believe, though, that devolution is there, it exists, and we've got to apply it. We have got to do what we believe, rightly or wrongly, is best for our electorate. There's always, no matter what position you're running for, you're always looking to the next time you run. You're always considering how any decision you make, any statement you make, will reflect to your core voters, okay? It's not the way politics should be done, but it's the nature of politics. It's unfortunate, but that's how it is. What I would say is that a devolved assembly has to provide for the people it represents, the same way as a council, if it had rights to set charges for bin collections, may decide to set a separate charge from a neighbouring council because it believes that's what's best. The freedom of devolution allows us to say we want to set our fees for our universities at that level, and it could be any devolved issue. It's, you know, universities is a good one. your point on the veterinary side of things, while there may be no people from Northern Ireland who are wanting to spend the money to travel to Scotland or wherever, because we don't do that at all at the moment, and we won't continue to do that, obviously, but you know, while they may decide not to travel, if there's suddenly a shortage of qualified vets in Northern Ireland, you can be damn sure people are going to move from England, Scotland, and the Republic up to take those jobs. It's not going to empty, you know, us out
so
in that respect.
So a huge shortage of doctors that we don't have an influx? Why are vets different?
Because we aren't putting the funding in place to cover the doctors. We don't actually have the huge shortage of doctors that we're talking about. The funding isn't there to provide the spaces that are available.
All of the gaps that are currently vacant are funded posts.
And how many of them have been actually openly advertised throughout the whole of the UK?
They're in the BMJ every week, British Medical Journal.
How many of those positions are providing the training or the development
of
the research? Developing the research as if you would have.
Now, funded by the Northern
one of the issues I've discussed already in relation to Coleraine in this is that there are doctors refusing to take Coleraine positions because they're not getting their research hours that they would be getting in other hospitals. And if those hours aren't available, then they can't progress down their path. So it's very much a case of identifying just exactly how like for like are these positions with other positions that are available.
Well, if you're talking about Coleraine Causeway, it's not a university linked hospital, so it's not a centre for research, so that doesn't.
But this is why they're saying they cannot develop the services down there, because they're not getting the doctors who will want to move down there to take positions on. I don't believe it is just the case that we're not training doctors in Northern Ireland, so doctors won't come to Northern Ireland. You know, there's no other profession.
No, what I'm saying is you're saying we don't need to worry about training who we need because they'll come from elsewhere, but I'm giving you an example of where that's not the case, and I'd like to know what you think is different about other professions that people are just going to come to Northern Ireland because there's a gap in the market. We have a gap in the market here for any doctor that wants a job. There's a job there, but they don't come.
If that is the case, if there is actually that number of paid vacancies available that aren't being filled, then either we're doing something fundamentally wrong in our approach through our health service to attract candidates, or there's something in place that is creating a bottleneck to stop them from coming. I don't believe, and as a conservative, I strongly believe that market forces drive people to where they can work. I believe that if there is an opportunity for employment, and particularly at the moment, either the whole of the UK is being undersubscribed for qualified doctors, or there is some failure in the system that is stopping them from being able to approach or get into positions in Northern Ireland. I know a number of doctors who have come from all over the world to work in Northern Ireland and have enjoyed the experience of doing so and have ended up staying and settling here. I've never heard before of any reason why people wouldn't choose to come here if the positions are available and they're qualified to do so and the employment terms and conditions are equal to what they can get elsewhere. So I would actually challenge just exactly what the situation is that's causing that vacancy or problem from happening. I don't believe it is purely just the fact that people don't want to come. I'm a qualified doctor, I'm not going to come to Northern Ireland. I believe there must be other contributing issues, which I would perhaps place at the door of our health service and the structure around that and the funding issues there as well. But I wouldn't just say immediately that, yes, there is an issue that we can't get qualified doctors. If the positions are there, if the positions are equal to positions elsewhere in the UK, if there are qualified doctors looking for work, then I don't understand, under a market force principle, why they wouldn't come to Northern Ireland.
But that's the point I'm making, is that if we rely on the market forces, and I can tell you that terms and conditions for doctors are on a national basis, so a doctor employed anywhere in the United Kingdom will be on the same employment contract.
Would receive a London wing if they worked in a London hospital.
But I think it is recognised that there is a difficulty trying to attract doctors and professionals to areas which are not conceived to be or perceived to be
high training areas,
metropolitan type areas with all the goods and services. But the point was about student fees, which was clearly very populist in terms of particularly people with young families who are going to go through university. But I agree with you. It's a disincentive to our young people to go away to come back, and it certainly is going to put a big pressure and drive up perhaps the entry requirements and make it for the social justice of it is very, very questionable. Ian, as a as a Scottish Conservative and a Unionist, how do you feel about the fact that it's 3,000 to go to university here, but 9,000 for you if you want to come?
Yep. I think we didn't massively do a great job of explaining our policy. I think our policies were very, when it comes down to tuition fees, I think we needed to be much bolder than we were at putting forward why there are fees and why there are costs involved in going to university. Much more articulate about our desire for our universities to be fully funded, so they can have courses on, so they can have a veterinary course, so they can afford to be having all these extra courses and all the courses that they want to be doing, but there is a cost to it, and that a graduate contribution, and I still prefer to call it a graduate contribution rather than a student fee, which again is an example of how we've been losing that, but how we've absolutely lost the sort of PR battle there, is that people talk about student fees rather than a graduate contribution, which is what it is. If you graduate and then you get a job that's paying above 22 grand a year, then you pay it back at a small amount for a low interest rate over the next however many years. If you're lucky enough to be able to pay it back early, you get a big discount on that as well. Do you know it is? It's a fair way of funding our universities, because it is a frustration when you see things like Queen's not having a vet, not doing veterinary in Belfast. Come on, right? It should be. But the universities need to be funded, and we've got other spending principles. But I do think it's more about, I think your question was more rather than about the specific on graduate contributions, was much more about how can you advocate against your party if there's something that, you maybe disagree on. But I do, I think it's helpful. One of the things that I've been interested as a businessman who's got, at the moment, my business, my head office is in, I think, notionally Glasgow, but it is. I've got an office around the corner here in Belfast. I've got an office in Edinburgh. I've been interested as a businessman looking as the ideas floated of corporation tax being lower in Northern Ireland than it is in Westminster. And then in Scotland and Holyrood, they're sitting going, oh, that might be a good idea if we could lower our corporation tax here. And I'm sitting going, fight. I'm sitting looking, going, very interested here, because actually, yeah, sure, my headquarters would move from Glasgow to Belfast and take advantage of those lower corporation tax. I might even have an extra job or two over here if that went down. And the same in Scotland, I'd be sitting going, who's got the lowest corporation tax? That's the one that suits me very nicely, thank you very much. But I see that much more as how the devolved parties can be sitting arguing, so I'd be looking for the Ulster Unionists, the Conservatives over here, to be saying, yeah, brilliant, let's bring some investment and bring some jobs in, give us lower corporation tax here in Northern Ireland, because in Northern Ireland we've got a special case, look how special our case is, it's A, B, C, D and E. And I'd be looking for the Scottish Conservatives to be saying, ignore them, forget them, look at our special case. Our special case is much more special than the special case in Northern Ireland, and give us the lower corporation tax there, because actually if we get that, we'll get all this investment and all this business, and our case is so much more special, so let's have that. But I see that much more as going out, being seen to go out to bat for me in Scotland. I'm going out to bat for business in Scotland. I want investment in Scotland. So here, this is not quite party policy, but this is me fighting for Scotland. Just at the same time, Bill will be sitting going, no. So we can have an argument about who's more special, Scotland or Northern Ireland. Who needs this business enterprise zone more?
Northern Ireland, obviously. But
well, obviously, I disagree. But that's much more a way that we can be coming out very clearly batting for our own country, our own community. And then folks are going, these guys, yeah, they're Scottish. They're having a wee fight with London there. And it's not just a fight for the fight's sake. It's a fight because actually it's probably a good idea.
Mm, but you don't have a land border with Euroland, so
it's tough. With Norway's oil. I think, if you look at the Canadian model, as I say, and again, I'm not particularly advocating it, I'm just tossing it in as another idea, you actually have separate parties. So you don't have that competition, because it would effectively be the equivalent of everybody who signed up to the Scottish Conservatives, the English Conservatives, the Welsh Conservatives and the Ulster Unionists would agree on matters that aren't devolved on reserved and accepted matters, and they wouldn't express widely differing opinions on those. Again, if you have a big figure, occasionally you could take a risk, Boris type figure, occasionally they might say, well, actually, we thought such and such a Libyan should have been released and we didn't and whatever else. But generally they would have to have an agreement, because going into a federal, national, whatever term you choose to put on it, general election, they have to have a common platform across the UK, because ultimately the Westminster Parliament will still be doing foreign policy, Europe, probably still most aspects of fiscal policy and so on. But at devolved or provincial level in Canada, they're separate parties, so they can say what they like. And that's your advantage of it. And people can be members of two at once. And you can talk to somebody who's a member of the same federal party that you are, but a different provincial party, because you differ on certain aspects of social and local economic policy. And that may be a strength. Initially, it appears very confusing, but it seems to work in Canada. And Canada has its own issues of very different types of province, and you've Quebec being a place apart and so on. But it seems to work there. So that's really how that would work. I still think that really it would be beneficial in a general election for parties in Northern Ireland to be saying that on aspects that are accepted, there are aspects that are dealt with at Westminster, we will take such and such a whip. Or at least to be very clear if they won't. Or perhaps to be very clear where they wouldn't. So what's been advocated in this case is Ulster Unionists would agree on all aspects of foreign policy, fiscal defence and so on, but they wouldn't on aspects related to Northern Ireland, on aspects that are still reserved related to Northern Ireland. That has certainly the value of being honest, because I as a voter then know exactly when I come to make my decision, well, I know what I'm getting. And I think that's where that's heading. You do have the difficulty in reverse, because the Conservatives may be sitting in London thinking, we're just a few votes short here, the Ulster Unionists would get us over the boundary, but we can't pass... You know, we can't apologise for Bloody Sunday or something. Could make it very interesting, but then perhaps that's the benefit. And something like that could happen in Scotland as well, where there's an aspect that's very specific to Scotland, where the Scottish Conservatives say, you're relying on us for your majority, but actually we're not going to give you that majority on a particular issue related to Scotland. That may just work. That's almost your return to the 50s. That may just work for Scotland.
But you can be pragmatic about stuff even now. You know, we're looking at the moment UK, the high speed two, the rail line, the high speed rail line is proven an interesting one for the whips to manage in Westminster, and that there are, you know, if there was, I would be very supportive of it if it was going from Edinburgh to London. I would love to see a high speed rail link from Edinburgh to London. That would be just top class to me, and I would be supporting that, saying what benefit to Edinburgh, and as an Edinburgh Conservative I'd be saying, look at what the Conservatives are doing for Edinburgh. The people in the Midlands, the Conservative MPs in the Midlands at the moment, they're fighting tooth and nail against this because it's wildly unpopular with their electorate, who are getting this high speed rail link right through their back garden, and they're not getting any benefit from it that they can see. No tangible benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And the folks in London going, great, a bit more business there. And you know, it's, I actually think the very credible thing is that actually the folks who it's affecting in a bad way, they're Conservative MPs, but they're fighting tooth and nail against it, whereas the folks it's affecting very positively, they're fighting tooth and nail for it. It's a credible thing. It doesn't break the party. I think we need to relax in our politics a little bit and say, do we all need to toe the same line all the time? No, because that's the incredible thing, is actually everybody agreeing on everything, because actually, yeah, what's good for Stoke Poges isn't necessarily good for Edinburgh, and it's quite right that the folks are going to have different views on that.
So being a unionist means celebrating diversity within.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think the tuition fees, the disparity situation that we have now, touches on two elements of this debate. One is the second part of Murdoch Fraser's new unionism, which is how comfortable are we on the centre-right collectively with devolution and disparity that might cause. He is saying that I am comfortable with fiscal devolution, I'm comfortable with difference across the UK, which marks a certain element of departure for perhaps the Scottish Conservatives. And the second element is what Ian Parsley was saying about we have a messy devolution system in the United Kingdom, and it's not clean, and it's the tuition fees issue exposed that. That the 9,000 tuition fees decision was an English decision made by English politicians. Is it incumbent upon Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales to automatically follow that? No, we have our own authority to set up a fees arrangement as we see correctly. If we wanted one UK fees, that should have been discussed between the four administrations. It wasn't. So something wasn't quite right there, and that we've ended up with the disparity that we have. And I think it exposes the need to really try and get a grip on where devolution is going and what it should be. I think it needs the to and fro, but Scotland's getting it cleaned up a bit through the Carlman Commission. Are we going to get it cleaned up in Northern Ireland through a Northern Ireland bill? Remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your Canadian model, but is there an entity similar to England? I mean, I think the problem with devolution in the United Kingdom is that asymmetrical relationship. I mean, if you were to take corporation tax, if we were to establish it here, say Tesco, Sainsbury's, massive companies start locating their business here, that's not going to be tolerated by the exchequer, it's not going to be tolerated by the English. Same with tuition fees. Will English parents forever tolerate the Barnett formula to subsidise low fees here that their children are going to get hammered if they choose to study here? Is there a way of fixing the devolution model?
Well, it's now 10 years since I saw chalked above a bridge in the M1 in Leicestershire, Home Rule for England, which I sympathised with to some extent, I have to say. It goes back to my point about this thing about the debate about Devo Max in Scotland, and as I see that, somebody resident outside Scotland, actually of an English father and a Northern Irish mother, I don't see how that can only be a Scottish decision, and I think the SNP actually has to be challenged on that, because they're getting away with that, saying this is a Scottish decision. As Ian said earlier, Conservatives and Lib Dems have no mandate here. Well, actually, for as long as the Scottish people wish to be part of the Union, they do have a mandate there, even if they hadn't voted for them in quite large numbers, which actually they did. And you touch on, ultimately you touch on the West Lothian question, and this has actually been running under current of legislation for some time. Even aspects like the Child Poverty Act that went through Westminster impinged slightly on Northern Ireland and Scotland, but not as totally as they did in England. So you couldn't even neatly do it the way some Conservatives have suggested and say, well, this is legislation for England, let's have English MPs only voting on it, because actually it's slightly impinged. So that's very difficult. The ultimate example I always give, what would happen if England decided to get rid of the National Health Service? It's always given as the ultimate example. Because the Barnett formula assumes that the devolved nations will do something much the same, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland would be in big trouble if they wanted to maintain it, because they'd have to find the entire budget from somewhere. It would be taken off them. And in our case, if the guts of 40% of our budget would suddenly go. And that's your problem. And I think really the only solution to that is to move towards fiscal devolution, where you have to, something like Calman, in all the devolved structures, including in Northern Ireland and Wales. And the problem with it is we're not even having the debate. The debate is ongoing in Scotland, and the rest of us aren't even involved in it. At some level, we have to get involved in it. I've long taken the view that Northern Ireland should, by and large, be as devolved as Scotland, largely because it produces that bit of symmetry you're talking about. But that's only the start of it. What do you do about England? I think New Labour went into it. Now, I really do hold Tony Blair guilty for this. He went into, I'm guilty for many things, Gordon Brown guilty for more things, I have to say. But he went into constitutional change without thinking about it in any detail. Firstly, he did things like Lords reform, electoral reform, Jenkins Commission, if you remember it, and devolution, all separately from each other, when I actually think they're fundamentally the same thing. If you're going to reform the Lords and have devolution, well, think about how the two are linked. He then decided to devolve Scotland at one level and give them a double referendum, and devolve Wales at another level, and devolve Northern Ireland, but it's different anyway, so we'll pretend that's completely aside. And he didn't think about what the inevitable outworking of that was going to be. And I think underlying it all, he'd been persuaded somewhere that the English would vote for regional parliaments. And I was at university in Newcastle upon Tyne, and used to go for drives around the Northumbrian countryside, and you see the Northumbrian flag up. It's as regionally distinctive places you'll get within England, but I'm convinced it's still an English regionalism. I was there when England played Scotland in Euro 96. They were English. It wasn't, yes, they were regional and they were Northumbrian and they were Geordie and whatever else, but still English. So when Prescott's vote came, it was defeated by 7-2, and I simply don't buy that there was some underlying current of, oh, they're attacking Brexit. They just didn't want it, because England is a single entity, has been for centuries upon centuries. So they just hadn't thought that one through. I've put forward proposals, but I don't think you can stop just at English MPs voting on English-only issues. I think you have to have an English executive at some level, even if it's within Parliament. Because you could, and I could foresee this happening within the next decade, you could end up with a Labour majority government, but with a Conservative majority in England. So if you did go your Conservative-only MPs route, you'd have a Labour government, you'd have cohabitation. They simply couldn't pass legislation in England. And there's no real reason you shouldn't have an English executive if that's the case. Perhaps that's a way around it, but you have to think about your executive functions and you have to think about your finance. And if we don't think about these things quickly and have this debate quickly, as I've said before, the nationalist argument will become more and more coherent, even in England, because it is the tidiest way to tidy it up. Let's just separate. And I always give, I've given on my blog, the warning of Czechoslovakia as an example of this, and I'm not pretending I'm overly familiar with Czechoslovakia, but there were very few people when the Berlin Wall fell who wanted Czechoslovakia to split up on either side, either the Czechs or the Slovaks. They were quite happy together, wanted to remain together. When it came to negotiating a democratic settlement which gave reasonable autonomy to either side, they simply couldn't. In the end, it was easier just to separate, form two countries, and then look each other in the eye as equal sovereign entities. And they've gone back now, and they have common sporting leagues, and they have common television programmes, and they recognise each other's languages, and they do all these things. But ultimately, they split up. And the risk for the United Kingdom is exactly that will happen. The majority of people could come simply to look at it and say, you know, the easiest thing here would be just to separate, be a bit like Scandinavia, and move on. Unless those who value the union react quickly and come up with a vision that's coherent, that involves executive power for England and that involves financial redistribution of power, then I think that's what will happen.
I think, and I agree with Ian, that Labour has a lot to pay for the mess it created in creating devolution the way it has. We do have to have this discussion at some point, and it has to be a very strong discussion. My concern about an English executive is one English executive won't work. You're going to then have sections within England claiming they deserve their own executive because they've got a bigger population or GDP than other members of the other devolved regions. So we end up then with a crazy United States of UK happening, and it just doesn't work. I do think the big problem is that what Labour hath given, nobody else can take away. You know, where we have gone with devolution, we can't come back from that. There's no way that any of the nationalist groupings here or in Scotland are going to allow for any return of power to central government. I don't see how we stop the slide we're on, and it concerns me as a unionist. It concerns me as somebody who genuinely believes that these four countries are very, very well put together, and they create something that can't be seen anywhere in any other model in the world. I'm just not sure, as a unionist, how we can create a solution that stops this drip, drip, drip of independence. But we have to find, as Ian said, we have to find a way damn quick, and we have to be standing up as a united unionist voice, and I mean the term unionist in a proper UK sense, not in a small Northern Irish sense. As unionists, we need to stand up and say we want the union to maintain because A, B, C, D. We need to start putting a pro-union argument across the whole of the UK. We need to undermine Salmond's campaign for Devo Max, because it is just one more step. We had an interesting conversation before this. Salmond's creating a border between Scotland and England. Sinn Féin are erasing a border between the North and South. They're using exactly the same tactics to receive the opposite. Unless we unite East-West and develop a campaign, a strategy, a message that revigorates a pro-union belief, we are heading down. Ultimately, I don't even think Ian's idea of federalism will work. It will ultimately be independence, and I, for one, feel sorry for Northern Ireland and Wales if that happens.
But no, you said earlier, and I think we're all aware, at least anecdotally, of people who would be procedurally from the Catholic Nationalist Republican community who would never vote unionist, but in a referendum would vote to maintain the union. And Ian, you're saying there are unionists who would vote SNP. So perhaps the threat to the union isn't as pronounced as you might think just to look at voting patterns. And Richard, maybe the best way to secure the union is to have the solid vision of the union that Ian says perhaps we, and particularly we as Ulster unionists, are lacking. Have you got one?
Well, firstly, on the English executive point, I think there already is one. It's called Westminster. The vast majority of its time is on English issues, the health bill and many other things. It's really Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales are bystanders looking on at English legislation going through Parliament. On devolution and the future of the union and is it coming apart, well, we can't go back to where we were, that's as Bill says, and where we are at the moment is messy and it's creating advantages to those forces that want to see a breakup. So we have to go somewhere else. And I think we need to look at models as to what works elsewhere. And I think